All right, well, welcome to our Wednesday study, and I'm very happy to see that my sister-in-law, Deidre Pendergrass, has joined us this evening. I didn't know that she was going to join, and I'm really pleased that she was able to. And as you know, we finished up Genesis last week, and we're starting a new book, the book of Exodus. And I'm always really excited for some reason about starting new books and finishing new books. I don't know why, but I'm really excited about Exodus. I really thoroughly enjoyed Genesis, and I'm really pleased that, you know, we were able to go through that and just how Genesis really lays a foundation for the rest of the Bible. In fact, we're going to see even tonight that some of these the things that we learned about in Genesis will come into play. And indeed, the book of Exodus is actually just a continuation of the book of Genesis. So we're going to be able to see that. So before we get going in the text of Exodus, I want to provide just a little bit of a background, which is something I typically do when we start a new book. So the book of Exodus is really the record of Israel's birth as a nation. And so we talked about this as we were going into the latter part of the book of Genesis, that that the Lord had a plan of taking Israel and bringing them into Egypt as a very small tribe or just a small clan, really, of 70 people. And he's going to use their time in Egypt, which will span approximately 430 years, to grow them up as a nation so that they are large enough to be able to go and inhabit that land that the Lord is giving to them. Like, they can completely occupy that land, and then they also will have the numbers and the strength to be able to overcome or overtake the people that are in that land. And so we've been talking about the fact that the Lord, his whole plan and what he did with Joseph, in having him go ahead and into the land and provide protection for the family and everything, that was all part of God's plan to get that the family of Israel into Egypt. And so now here they are in the protective womb. And so, you know, a lot of the words and the things that we're talking about, it's going to sort of speak of birth, right? Because that's what is taking place here, this birth of a nation. So when they're in Egypt, they're in this sort of this protective womb. You know, Israel's original family of 70 people will end up multiplying rapidly. And then in God's perfect timing, with great birth pains, this infant nation that will go from 70 people to somewhere between 2 and 3 million people, they will be brought, you know, out of Egypt and into the world, where they will be divinely protected and fed and nourished by God. Now, the Hebrew title of this book of Exodus is Now These Are the Names. That's the actual title in the Hebrew Bible, and it comes from the first verse of Exodus. Now These Are the Names. I thought that was an interesting thing, and the fact that it begins with the word now, it really does show that this is just a continuation of the book of Genesis. But here we're going to find that the beginning part of Exodus is some 250 to 300 years after the events of the last chapter of the book of Genesis. So between, you know, the last verse of Exodus and the first verse, I mean, the last verse of Genesis and the first verse of Exodus, you have like a 250 to 300 year period of time that has transpired. Now, the Greek title of the of the book of Exodus, it derives from the most significant event in the book, right? So that word Exodus means to exit or to depart or to go out. And so instead of, so the focus of the Septuagint or the Greek version of the Bible is to focus on that most significant event that occurs in the book. The author of this book, as with the first five books of the Bible, is Moses. And you know, usually when I go through and I talk about the various, you know, I give a background on the on a new book. You know, you get kind of to this point where, you know, there's that sort of that issue of, you know, who wrote it? And there are all these people. And this is the funny thing is that, you know, people who go to these institutes of higher learning or whatever, you know, they're always questioning, right? They're always, you know, questioning, you know, is it really Moses who wrote the book? And, you know, was it Paul who wrote, you know, the book of Ephesians or whatever, you know, and it's so funny is that, you know, you can get so smart that you don't know anything, right? So there are all these different people who are skeptics about, you know, did Moses really write it? But there are a number of different, you know, quotes from different parts of the Bible that I just want to refer to that, to me, just settle the matter, right? So First Kings chapter 2, verse 3, you see David, he's giving instructions to his son Solomon, and he says, keep the charge of the Lord your God to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his judgments, and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you you do and wherever you turn. But then, of course, to me, the most... The strongest support for Moses as being the author is of Jesus, the words of Jesus himself in two places in the New Testament. So in Mark chapter 7, verse 10, we see Jesus quoting Exodus chapter 20, verse 12 and Exodus 21, verse 17, where it says, for Moses said, honor your father and mother, and he who curses his father and mother, let him be put to death. And so that's a pretty strong endorsement when Jesus refers to the book and says, you know, that Moses is the author. Another place where Jesus does this is in Mark chapter 12, verse 26. In this place, he quotes Exodus chapter 3, verse 6, and it says, have you not read in the book of Moses, in the burning bush passage, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And so, like I said, in my view, it's a settled matter that Moses was the one who wrote this book. And the next thing is really sort of the timing, like when was this book written? When did these events occur? And the answer to the second, which is, you know, when did the events of Exodus occur? They occurred in 1446 BC. So the actual time when they departed out of Egypt was 1446 BC. And what's really interesting about that is that the Bible, like, gives, it supplies information that helps you to see that, like, with complete accuracy. So in 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 1, it tells about the time between the Exodus and the beginning of the construction of Solomon's temple. So in that verse, it says that it was 480 years from between the time of the Exodus out of Egypt and the beginning of the construction of Solomon's temple. It also states in that verse that the construction began in the fourth year of Solomon's reign, and that would have been 966 BC. And so when you do the math, you take 966, you add 480 years, you get to 1446 BC. So that tells you that. And then one other thing we'll just say is that, you know, in terms of, like, sort of when did Jacob enter Egypt? And that is also supplied here because in Exodus chapter 12, verses 40 through 42, it tells that the duration of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years to the very day. So if you take 1446 and you add 430 years, you get to 1876 BC. So it just kind of gives you a kind of an idea, at least when these events occurred. The theme of the book of Exodus is redemption. So it is recording God's redemption of Israel out of the bondage of Egypt. You know, so they were slaves in Egypt. And this is all a picture or a type of the greater redemption or the salvation that Jesus provides to us, taking us not out of a physical bondage to a Pharaoh or someone like that, but out of a spiritual bondage or slavery to the evil of this world under the taskmaster of Satan. And so that's the basic background. There's one other thing I wanna say before we get into the text here, and that is that one of the things that's really interesting about the book of Exodus, and I kind of alluded to it a little bit in what I was saying when I prayed, and that is that in Genesis we talked a lot about how the Lord brings a believer along in their faith. And we saw that with Abraham and how, you know, when the Lord first appeared to Abraham and he began to deal with him and tell him about the promises that he's made to him and how he's going to give him a son and how he's going to multiply them greatly and he's going to bring him into the land and all these different things. And so the Lord began working with Abraham and he would be speaking to Abraham and along the way Abraham is obeying, but you know he's making mistakes along the way, but he's growing and you get to see that whole progression. You see the same thing with Isaac, and you certainly see it with Jacob. And so we talked about that a lot, you know. But one of the things that really stood out to me as I started to really dig in and prepare for Exodus is that we're really going to get to see that, but even more so here in Exodus. So in Genesis, when we were looking at men like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you would see the Lord appearing to them and speaking to them, but there would be these very long periods of time between the times that are recorded where the Lord is, you know, there is an encounter between God and these men. That's not to say that God wasn't dealing with them on a day-to-day basis, just like he does with all believers. But the way that it's recorded in the word is that you're only seeing like these sort of these major events that are taking place, you know, in these intervals. Whereas here, you're with Moses, you're going to see the Lord. You're going to see it's like very close, like very up close and personal, and it's very frequent, like it's continuous. And so we're not only going to get to see how the Lord deals with a believer, with a man, with a leader, and how he brings them along, but we get to see like kind of like a more frequent, more of a kind of an everyday kind of thing. So that's just one of the things that really stuck out to me that I thought was really that's really amazing about this book. And the other thing too is that we're going to get to see a lot about a lot more about the character of God. I mean, so we've encountered the Lord in Genesis, and we've seen how he has dealt with these men and with the people, you know, that he has chosen and so forth. But we're really going to get to see different things. Like we're going to see how, you know, when the Lord is dealing with Moses and how, you know, the Lord will be able to talk about him, his anger being kindled. And it's going to, you know, just talk about some really interesting things that are kind of in some ways difficult to kind of understand in a way. But I think that as we go through this, we're going to get to really understand some of the attributes of God and so forth that are going to be a real blessing for us. So let's go ahead and dig in here. We'll try to cover a couple of chapters here, and so let's start out and read a few verses, and we'll talk about it. So Exodus chapter 1, verse 1 reads, "Now these are the names of the children of Israel who came to Egypt. Each man and his household came with Jacob: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah; Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin; Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. All those who were descendants of Jacob were 70 persons, for Joseph was in Egypt already." And so here we see these are the names. These are the ones that the Lord had to work with. And we see that they were not only, in verse 1, they were not only children of Israel, but they were also of the household of Jacob. And so we remember that you know, there we have Jacob, right? And Jacob is his name from birth, right? And Jacob would represent, you know, just the man, you know, the man, you know, prior to being sanctified, you know, because there was that later time when Jacob wrestled with God, and we said that was kind of a type of being sanctified, right? And so we, after the Lord changed Jacob's name to Israel, which meant governed by God, right? We saw that there were times in the text where he would be referred to as Jacob or Israel, and that really represented how, you know, as you're coming along in your walk, there are some times when you might kind of revert or be acting in your old nature, you know, kind of the Jacob kind of nature versus the Israel kind of nature. And so here we see that these 12 are children of Israel, right? The one who's governed by God, but they're also children of the man, right? The one who even before he knew he you know, he was really sanctified. And the other thing is that, you know, when we read in that last chapter of Genesis, or actually it was in the 49th chapter where Jacob was pronouncing blessings upon all of the of his sons and talking about even their bad points, right, and making warnings or whatever. So we know all about these men, Reuben, Simeon, and all that. Some of them had some bad characteristics, some had some really good characteristics and so forth. But the one thing that I was struck with is that, you know, these are the ones that the Lord had to work with. And God, he stays true to his promise. He made a promise to Abraham. He reiterated that promise to Isaac and to Jacob. And he wasn't going back on that promise. He was going to create a great nation, and he was going to multiply them, and he was going to use what he had. And it reminds me of just of the fact that, you know, where Jesus talks about, you know, those who are not sick, they don't need a physician, right? It's the ones who are sick who need a physician. And so the point is that the Lord, he takes his people and he carries out his promise irrespective of what they may do, whether they deserve it, whether they don't deserve it. He does it because of the promise that he made, and he will always be true to his promise. And so he's pointing back and he's you know, reminding us, these are the ones who came in. These are the ones who were the descendants, right? Verse 5, all those who were the descendants, because he said he was going to greatly multiply his descendants and make them like the stars of the sky. And so then it says here, verse 6, and Joseph died, and all his brothers and all of that generation, they all died. Then it goes on in verse 7 to say, but the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and grew exceedingly mightily, and the land was filled with them. And so you can see from the language here that this is one of those cases where you can see how the Holy Spirit knows how to use words so effectively, increased abundantly, multiplied, grew exceedingly mightily. Like, this is going out of its way to give us the impression, to make it known to us, to leave no doubt that these people were really being blessed and they're being multiplied, but they're being multiplied in a supernatural way. This is not just like just a regular sort of progression of people going from 70 up to larger numbers. There's something about this, and you can see it in the language, and you can see by the reaction of this of the Pharaoh, which we're going to see in a few moments, that this was supernatural. Like, it was something that you're looking at it and you're thinking, wow, there's something about those people. They're being blessed here, and this is not normal. This is real growth, real multiplication here. Verse 8 says, "Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph." And I always, that's a verse that's just kind of funny to me, and it's something that actually Stephanie and I, we sometimes will quote that, that happens sometimes, right? Where, you could be, or even Pastor Bob kind of talks about this a little bit, like, you could be working in a job and have a really good thing going on. Your boss, you have a lot of favor with your boss and with your boss's boss and everything else. And then all of a sudden, there's a change in management. And then next thing there's a Pharaoh there who doesn't know, your Richard, right? Who doesn't know the things that you've done in the past and so forth. And so it's just funny how these circumstances came to be, but they're all in God's plan here. Verse 9, it says, "And he said to his people," and that is this new king, "Look, the people of the children of Israel are more mighty than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and it happen in the event of war, that they also join our enemies and fight against us. So go up out of the land." Okay, so we see here that there's this fear that is coming over this king and over the people of Egypt, where they just felt like, man, the children of Israel are going to overtake us, and they're concerned that even that they would rise up and they would do war against Egypt. And when I've read this, it just made me think of something, and that is that the one thing that is a constant theme with our enemy, with Satan, is to try to oppose God at every turn. In other words, Satan is always wanting to prove God wrong or to make a mockery of his creation or his promises. And so when God spoke to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, and he says, "I'm going to make you a great nation. I'm going to multiply you and make you a mighty nation," Satan hears that, and he's gonna try to oppose it. And that's one thing that, this is something we all should never forget, should always remember, is that Satan is always going to be looking to try to make God out to be a liar, or to make God out to be, to make a mockery of God, make a mockery of his creation, of his promises. And we see that all throughout the Bible, but we also see it in the world as well. So I'll give you a few examples that came to mind for me. So remember in Genesis chapter 1, it talks about how God made man, right, in his own image, male and female, made he them. In today's world, people would say, "I don't know for sure, right? I don't know if, I'm looking at this person, they have all of the outward characteristics of a woman, but I don't know, maybe they're a man. Maybe it's a man trapped in a woman's body or something," right? Again, it's one of these things where we become so educated that all of a sudden now we don't know anything, right? We can't tell that a person is a man or a woman, you know. Another example would be that, you know, God says, I'm going to give you this land, right? I'm going to give you this land of Canaan as an everlasting covenant. And then now we see people saying that, the Jews, they're not supposed to have that land, and they're oppressing the people, and they should share it, and they should do this and have a treaty and all this other stuff, right? But the reality is that, God made these promises. God said these things. And the reason why people are doing all these things is because Satan is looking to thwart what God is trying to do. So this is something to keep in mind, because it applies in a lot of other different ways, right? It applies in how we might look in the New Testament, looking at like what Paul says or what Peter says. In the New Testament, you'll read things like, that we are, a royal priesthood, we are a chosen people, or all the different things about what the Lord says, that, if any man be in Christ, he's a new creature, whatever it is. And, Satan will be trying to oppose that. He'll be trying to tell you, no, you're not a new creature. You're just the same. You're not a good person. You're not, the Lord is not going to save you like he said he was going to save you, or whatever the case may be. But understand that Satan is going to try to talk against what God says and what he has promised. And the world is going to try to talk against what God has said and what he has promised. All I would say is let us not be a part of that. Let us never be ones to read or to think about what God has said and say, oh no, that's not true. Even when you're discouraged, and you're just feeling like, man, I just keep blowing it, man. I just keep on, not doing things. There must be something wrong with me. But maybe the Lord, maybe this works for everybody else, but it doesn't work for me. I would just say, like, let's believe God. Let's take him at his word. Let's understand that God is going to do what he promises that he's going to do, and that we are pleasing to him when we believe his promises and we hold to those. So let's keep going here. Verse 11 says, therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramses. And so here we see that they began to, enslave them and make them work hard, and they afflicted them, just as the Lord had told Abraham in Genesis chapter 15 that they would be taken to this land where they are here in Egypt. They would be here for over 400 years. And they would be afflicted. And so they are now having the Jews build these supply cities, these military cities where they're afflicting them in this way. But look at what happens here in verse 12. It's really interesting. It says, but the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were in dread of the children of Israel. And so here we find a really peculiar thing that occurs constantly, right? We see it in the Word of God, and we see it in our everyday lives, that the more that they were going after them, they were afflicting them, the more they multiplied and grew. And God has a way of doing that. He has a way of taking circumstances and actually turning it against, our enemy. And so here they are afflicting them, trying to make their numbers go smaller. And the more they're afflicting them, the more they're growing. And it says here that there was this dread that they had of the children of Israel. They began to be fearful of the children of Israel, because, oh my goodness, like, what's going on here? They can't be stopped. Verse 13, it says, so the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor, and that with rigor means to death. Like they were working him to death, and you know what they were trying to do again is to eliminate them. But most importantly, they wanted to eliminate the males, right? Because they saw them as a military threat, and we saw that in the earlier when it said that in verse 10 it says, "And it happened in the event of war that they join our enemies and fight against us." So they were afraid of that. So they were really trying to work them to death here. Verse 14, "And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar and brick and in all manner of service in the field. And their service in which they made them serve was with rigor." And so they're making them work hard here. But, you know, the Lord is going to use this, right? The Lord is going to use this, the treatment that the Egyptians were treating the Israelites with. He's going to use that to help to push the Israelites away, you know, because if they were comfortable there in Egypt and, you know, everything was fine and everything else, then they would want to stay. But this, you know, the Lord is allowing this. And this is, you know, it's really funny how the enemy, when the enemy comes and opposes God, God has a way of using the opposition for his purposes. You just can't, it's just impossible to thwart God. And so he's going to use the fact that they were treated so badly to help them to want to get out of there. Verse 15, "Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Shipra, and the name of the other was Pua. And he said, 'When you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, then you will kill him. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live.'" And so here we see that this Pharaoh, this king of Egypt, is getting desperate, because when he saw that trying to work him to death didn't work, then he goes, "Oh my, I gotta do something," you know. And so now he's going to take matters into his own hands. He's going to up the ante here, and he's going to try to use the Hebrew midwives to get to the male sons. Again, the male ones were important to eliminate because of the military threat. The one thing I just love about this verse 15, when I read this, is the fact that the Lord, the Holy Spirit, goes out of his way to name these midwives by name here. So he, because of what they did, the noble things that they did, the fear that they had of God, he gives them an everlasting honor of giving their names out here. When I see that, it just blows me away that the Lord did that here. But here they were given instructions, very clear instructions, that they were to kill the male children when they were having when they were born here. But let's just see what they did. And I like the way that verse 17 begins. It says, but the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but he saved the male, but saved the male children alive. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said, "Why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive?" And the midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them." And so here we see that they had a fear of God, and that's just an amazing thing. That is from the Holy Spirit. You know, in Isaiah, it talks about kind of the sevenfold attributes of the Spirit, and one of them is the fear of God. And the fear of God is not just something that, you know, you just tremble. It causes you to do something, right? It causes you to be a certain way. The key here is that they had a fear of God that was what is really communicated here is that their fear of God was greater than the fear of man. But that fear, the fear was not just of any man, but it was a fear of the most powerful man in the world at this time. And so, but this is, I think this is a really important thing to talk about a little bit. And that is that, you know, the Bible is very clear, especially in the New Testament, that we are to obey governmental authorities, okay? But there is one exception, right? And so here we have the king of Egypt, who is a governmental authority, and so they're supposed to obey a decree from the government. And a reason why I wanted to take the time to talk about this a little bit is because this is something that's relevant for us right now, right? Like with this coronavirus situation, you know, and in terms of, you know, the government is saying that, you know, we're to stay at home or to do certain things, right? And there's a time period where, you know, we were not able to go into our churches and meet in our churches, and we're still in that time period, but it appears to be coming to a close. And, you could say, well, you know, I'm not listening to the government, you know, this is, I'm being oppressed and everything else. And, but the reality is that, you know, we're blessed to be able to continue to worship as we are. And those laws are not targeting our faith in that kind of way, but it's really important that we do obey the government, because it goes to our witness in this world, right? If we were to be rebellious, right, and against the government, you know, that would not be a good thing for our witness. But there is an exception. There's an exception, and that is when the decree from the government, it goes against a direct command of God, as it does here, then that is when your fear of God is greater than that fear of man. In other words, what they said is that they knew that they were not to be murdering these children, as the king of Egypt was commanding them to do. And so they were, the fear of the consequences of God were greater than any consequence that this king of Egypt could place upon them. And so they chose to honor God and to follow his commands. And so we see what they do here. The king of Egypt calls them and he says, why have you done this thing? You know, you're saving the male children alive. And they give an answer. They say, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them. So, you know, some people use this to say, well, you know, they were lying or something like that, you know, to be able to accomplish God's purposes. And that, you know, some people might use this as a proof text to say that, you know, it's okay for us to lie for God's benefit or so forth. I'm not sure that that's what is happening here, but certainly this wouldn't be a proof text to say that the Lord wants us to lie, and that we can accomplish his purposes that way. I think that what they did was, you know, they knew midwives are really skilled. I mean, anyone who knows about midwives and so forth, they know the birthing process, like, they really know it very, very well. They know the timing of it and everything else. And so what they did here is that when someone says, oh, you know, such and such is in labor, you know, we need you to come, they just took their time. They knew how long it took for them to give birth, and they just made sure they got there after it took place, because they did not want to do anything that was dishonoring to God. And so they probably just slow played the situation here. And so look what happens here in verse 20. It says that, therefore God dealt well with the midwives and the people multiplied and grew very mightily. And so it was, because the midwives feared God, that he provided households for them. And so we see here that God honored them because of how they feared him, and they did the right thing and not killing the male children. And it says here that the people multiplied and grew very mightily. And so we see here that you just cannot stop God's word. You cannot. As much as this king of Egypt tried to stop it, as much as Satan, who was behind this king of Egypt, tried to stop, you cannot stop God from accomplishing his purposes and for carrying through with any promise that he's made. And so it says here in verse 20, it says, because the midwives feared God, that he provided households. And what that means when it says provided households, it doesn't mean that he gave them like a really big palace, right, or some big house to live in. What it meant here is that he gave them children. That's what it meant for them to have a household, is he allowed them to be fertile and to have children. Verse 22 says, so Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. And so here we see Pharaoh, before he was just, you know, going to this, you know, these midwives, right, and trying to address this issue that way. Now he makes this commandment to everybody. So now it's like it's out there, right? The whole world knows what you're supposed to do. And so he's really upping the ante here. And this really demonstrates, an absolute zero regard for human life, right? And so we can look at this and think, you know, what does this remind you of? You know, it kind of reminds you of the time we're living in right now, where the people just don't have any regard for human life. So now, as we go into chapter 2, and we'll just start chapter 2 and see how far we can go here, we see now the beginnings of God preparing a man, right? Preparing a leader. We're going to see about the birth of Moses and his preparation. Now, one thing that struck me about this is that all of these events that are taking place with the affliction of the people, with the Pharaoh going after the children and trying to kill them and everything else, when the Lord raises up this leader, it's literally going to take 80 years before this leader is ready and will take the children of Israel out of this situation. And so, you know, look at that and you just think, you know, sometimes, you know, God, you know, he does things in his timing. You know, you think, man, 80 years, like what did it take so long, you know? But, you know, the Lord, again, he does things in his perfect timing and in his way. So let's look at this. So chapter 2, verse 1 says, and a man of the house of Levi went and took as wife a daughter of Levi. So the woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him for 3 months. And so here we see both husband and wife are from the house of Levi, and so clearly this Moses, we're going to see that this is Moses who's being born here, is a Levi through and through. And we see that they got married. And the thing that's interesting in verse 2 is it says that the woman conceived and bore a son. And you can think about like the different times in human history, right? You can think about even now, right? You just think about all of the corruption and all of the violence and everything going on. And you can think to yourself like, man, like I would never want to bring a child into the world in these times, you know, like, but think about this, you know, that they actually brought this child into the world during all of this, during this slavery, affliction, where they were killing children and everything else, they were still they were still, you know, brought a child into the world. And boy, what if they didn't? What if they had not brought a child into the world? We wouldn't have this deliverer, Moses. I mean, clearly God could use and raise up anybody, but this really goes to show that, you know, there's no reason why, you know, the Bible does provide, you know, Paul talks about how, you know, it is a blessing if you have this gift, right, of singleness and not, you know, having children and so forth, that you can focus on the Lord fully and everything else. But if you are married, there's no reason to not, you know, have children. And we can see that they certainly didn't shy away from it here. And verse 2 says that she saw that the child was a beautiful child. So basically, he was healthy and beautiful. And she hid him for three months. Verse 3 says, but when she could no longer hide him, she took an ark of bulrushes for him, daubed it with asphalt and pitch, and put the child in it and laid it in the reeds by the river's bank. And so here, you know, it got to the point where she could no longer hide the child. And so she decided to trust in God. And instead of just merely throwing the child into the river, she put the child into this basket and put asphalt and pitch so that the basket would float, and just put her faith in God. And what's interesting about this is that in a way, she obeyed the decree of the king to, you know, to put the child into the river. She just put the child into a basket here. And then we see here that there was provision made here. In verse 4, it says, and his sister stood afar off to know what would be done to him. And we know that Moses actually had two siblings, right? He had an older sister, Miriam, who is being spoken of here in this verse, who was 5 to 8 years older than him. And then he also had an older brother, Aaron, who was 3 years older than him. And we'll learn about them later, more about them. But look at what happens here. Verse 5, it says, and the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, and her maidens walked along the riverside. And when she saw the ark among the reeds, she sent her maid to get it. And when she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby wept. So she had compassion on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. And so this is all working out, right, in God's plan. You know, she puts the child on the river there, and lo and behold, it goes, and the daughter of Pharaoh sees the child. And when she opens up the basket, it says that she had compassion, which means that she felt sorry for him when she opened it up. And in my mind, there's no doubt that the Lord gave her that compassion or that pity for him. Verse 7, it says, then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women, that she may nurse a child for you? And I that's so amazing, you know, that here this young child would have the courage, right, and the faith to call out here and to say this. And verse 8 says, and Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go. So the maiden went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages. So the woman took the child and nursed him. What an amazing thing, right, that has taken place here. So what we have here is we have the Lord divinely protecting this child, Moses, from Pharaoh's decree that all the males would be killed. And also, we find that this Moses here is going to be cared for by his own mother. Like, she's going to nurse him. And she's going to be compensated for it. What an amazing thing that the Lord did here. And so this is, shows you this is the power of God, right? Being able to make all these things work out. I mean, so, you know, the Lord is going to raise this man up. Like I said, he's doing an amazing thing here, and having Moses being under the protection of the royal family, he's going to get adopted by the Roman, the royal family here. And then we see a sentence here at the very end of verse 9. It says, "So the woman took the child and nursed him." And we can understand that she likely did more than just nurse him during this time. She likely taught him many things, right? Many things about his heritage. And this just goes to show you, when you see what happens to Moses when he grows up, and how he knows that he is a Hebrew, and how he knows about the destiny of Israel and so forth, that she taught him all of those things. And it just goes to show that, you know, she weaned him. So she probably nursed him until he was, you know, who knows? In those days, it was a lot longer than we nurse children. He probably could have been somewhere between 3 and 5 years old when he was weaned. And so that is a very important window, right? A lot of times, you know, parents and grandparents, right, we think that, oh, you know, when they're really young like that, you can't really teach them. They're not really hearing. They're not really learning, whatever. But rest assured that during this window of time, you can really pour in a lot into a child. And it's a very important time for, you know, reading and telling the children's stories and just, you know, bringing them along in the way of the Lord. It will pay off. In verse 10, it says, "And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. So she called his name Moses, saying, because I drew him out of the water." And so we see here that, you know, that this child, you know, grew up. And then so now she brings, the mother brings him to Pharaoh's daughter. And then he gets adopted, basically, gets formally adopted. And we know from Acts chapter 7 that Moses was educated in all of the wisdom of the Egyptians. But we also know that later on, he's going to give up that Egyptian heritage, refusing to know to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. But what's really important about what the Lord, you know, again, we know from what we read about in Genesis, and how what the Lord did with Joseph and everything, that these things don't happen by accident. These are things that the Lord has orchestrated. But just the wisdom of the Lord and being able to bring Moses into the royal family, that was a big deal, because then now he would be taught of all of the wisdom of Egypt and how their language and how they do things, how they think about things. As a result, when he had to go and appear before Moses, I mean, before Pharaoh years down the road, he would have a certain comfort level or a certain familiarity about going and standing before the Pharaoh and being in his presence and, you know, kind of how they think and how they do things and so forth. So we can see here that this was a divinely inspired thing that has taken place here. You know what, I'm gonna go ahead and stop right here. We're at a time here, but we'll pick up next week where we left off. And we're just, you know, getting started here. We're just getting into this. This is starting to unfold. And we're gonna get to really see, like I said, how the Lord deals with and brings Moses along, and how he delivers his people out of Egypt. So